Serial killers have a long history. They have captured the public imagination and been the subjects of books, films, and TV shows. Ever since the development of psychoanalysis by Sigmund Freud, probing into the human mind, few subjects command such attention. So prevalent were serial killers, the FBI created a behavioral assessment unit studying these predators, their methods, predilections, and the origins of their demented thought processes. But one man stood out, pillar of the community, a high roller in Democrat politics, who made strong political contacts and worked children's birthday parties, playing a clown for their amusement, all the while racking up a body count that still staggers the mind. Who was John Wayne Gacy? What were his crimes? Who were his targets? How did he get away with his crimes for so long? How did he get caught? Hello, I'm Colin Heaton, former history professor, Army and Marine Corps veteran, and welcome to this episode of Forgotten History. John Wayne Gacy was born March 17, 1942, in Chicago, Illinois, the second of three children and only son of John Stanley Gacy, a World War I veteran and auto repair machinist, and Marion Elaine Robeson, a housewife. Gacy's father was abusive towards him, calling him dumb and stupid, a sissy, and a mama's boy who would grow up queer while showing more concern for his sisters. At age four, Gacy's father beat him severely for accidentally disarranging car engine components. He received another beating, very severe, after he and another boy were caught sexually touching a young girl. Later, a family friend began to molest Gacy, who never told his father, afraid that he would be blamed. Gacy loved his father despite the abuse, but always felt that he was never good enough in his father's eyes. As a child, Gacy was overweight and unathletic and could not play sports due to a heart arrhythmia, and Gacy had experienced blackouts and was hospitalized on occasion. He was again hospitalized in 1957 for a burst appendix. Gacy's medical condition was never conclusively diagnosed, and his father accused him of malingering and faking illnesses. Between ages 14 and 18, he had spent almost a year in hospital, causing him to fall behind in his education, and he did not graduate high school. In 1960, at age 18, Gacy became an assistant precinct captain for a local Democratic Party candidate, which his father loathed. Gacy left home and drove to Las Vegas, Nevada, with only $136 to live on, to go stay with a cousin, and he worked as an ambulance assistant. He was later transferred to Palm Mortuary, working as an attendant for 3 months, watching the embalming of bodies and serving as a pallbearer. He lived in the mortuary, and one evening he got into the coffin of a teenaged male for some private time. Afterward, Gacy decided to return home. Returning to Chicago, Gacy enrolled at Northwestern Business College, although never completing high school, graduating in 1963. He became a management trainee with the Nunn Bush Shoe Company when the company transferred him to Springfield, Illinois, in 1964 to work as a salesman. They promoted him to department manager, and he dated his future wife and co-worker, Marlon Myers. Gacy and Myers married in September 1964 and moved to Waterloo, Iowa, and her father purchased three Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurants. Gacy managed all three at an annual salary of $15,000, or about $155,000 in today's money per year, and they lived in Marlon's parents' old home. Gacy opened a club in his basement where his employees could drink alcohol, play pool, but Gacy only socialized with his teenaged male employees and began grooming the young men after drinking, testing to see which may be receptive. Gacy also became a member of the JCs and often provided fried chicken at meetings, and he wanted to be called Colonel. The dark side of the JCs was that Gacy and others were deeply involved in drugs, pornography, prostitution, and wife swapping. Gacy had a son in February 1966 and a daughter in March 1967. Gacy later described his life as perfect since he finally earned his father's approval. In fact, during a visit in July 1966, his father apologized for the abuse he gave him, saying, "Son, I was wrong about you," and he shook Gacy's hand. In 1967, Gacy was named Outstanding Vice President of the Waterloo Jaycees and served on the Board of Directors, and in 1965, he was honored as the third most outstanding JC in Illinois. Gacy said that he had his second homosexual experience when a friend of the JCs got him drunk and invited him to stay over on his sofa, and the friend performed a sexual act on him. In August 1967, Gacy sexually assaulted a young Donald Voorhees Jr., the son of Donald Edwin Voorhees, a fellow JC and local politician. Gacy lured the young Voorhees to his house, showing him stag films, and gave him alcohol. Gacy then persuaded him to engage in mutual sex, adding, "You have to have sex with a man before you start having sex with women." Gacy abused several other youths over the following months, including one whom he encouraged to have sex with his own wife and then blackmailed him into having sex with him. Gacy also convinced some children into believing that he was commissioned to conduct homosexual experiments for scientific research and paid them up to $50 each. Voorhees finally told his father, who informed the police. Gacy was arrested and charged with oral sodomy and attempted sexual assault of teenager Edward Lynch. Gacy denied any wrongdoing in all cases, insisting the charges were politically motivated since Voorhees Sr. had opposed Gacy's nomination for appointment as president of the JCs. Gacy demanded a polygraph, which was indicative of deception. Others believed Gacy and supported him. Then on May 10, 1968, Gacy was indicted on the sodomy charge. On August 30th, Gacy promised his employee, Russell Schroeder, $300 if he beat up Voorhees to prevent him from testifying in court. Schroeder lured Voorhees to a park, sprayed mace in his face, and beat him. Voorhees reported this to police, and Schroeder was arrested the next day. Schroeder denied the charges at first, but soon confessed and said that Gacy had hired him. Police arrested Gacy again and charged him with the assault and witness intimidation. Gacy was ordered to undergo a psychiatric evaluation at the Psychiatric Hospital of the University of Iowa on September 12. Two doctors concluded that he had an antisocial personality disorder, was unlikely to benefit from treatment, and all that his behavior pattern was likely to bring him was conflict and repeated conflict with society. Gacy was, however, ruled mentally competent to stand trial. On November 7, 1968, Gacy pleaded guilty to one count of assault on Voorhees, but not guilty to the charges related to other youths. He claimed Voorhees had offered himself to him and that he had acted out of curiosity. Gacy was convicted on December 3rd and sentenced to 10 years imprisonment at the Anamosa State Penitentiary, and Gacy's wife filed for divorce. She was awarded the property, sole custody of their two children, and alimony on September 18, 1969. Gacy never saw his first wife or children again. But Gacy was a model prisoner, becoming head cook, but was denied parole in June 1969. So, to prepare for a second scheduled parole hearing in May 1970, he completed 16 high school courses, obtaining his diploma in November 1969. On Christmas Day 1969, Gacy's father died from cirrhosis. When informed of his father's death, his request to attend the funeral was denied. After serving only 18 months, Gacy was presented with a Distinguished Service Award for his work with the inmates in the JC chapter in February 1970 and was granted parole with 12 months probation on June 18, 1970. His probation required a nightly curfew and relocation to Chicago to live with his mother. Gacy was picked up from prison by his friend and fellow JC, Clarence Lane, who believed in Gacy's innocence. Gacy told him that he would, quote, never go back to jail, and Gacy soon began working as a short order cook. Gacy was again charged with sexually assaulting a young man on February 12, 1971, whom he had lured into his car at Chicago's Greyhound bus terminal and driven to his home, where he attempted to force himself on the boy. The court dismissed this complaint when the boy failed to appear in court. During 1971, Gacy established a part-time construction business, PDM Contractors, for painting, decorating, and maintenance. With the approval of his probation officer, Gacy worked evenings on construction jobs and working as a cook during the day. He did minor repair work, but later expanded to include projects such as interior design, remodeling, and landscaping. On June 22, 1971, Gacy was arrested again and charged with aggravated sexual battery and reckless conduct after a youth who claimed that Gacy had shown him a sheriff's badge had then abused him. These charges were dropped after the complainant attempted to blackmail Gacy. The Iowa Board of Parole did not learn of these incidents, and his parole ended on October 18, 1971, and Gacy's criminal convictions in Iowa were sealed. Gacy bought a house at 8213 West Somerdale Avenue, where he lived until his arrest in December 1978, and, according to Gacy, committed all his murders there. Gacy was socially active in his community and helpful towards his neighbors. He loaned his tools and plowed snow free of charge, and from 1974 to 1978, he hosted themed annual summer parties where up to 400 people attended, including politicians and business associates. In August 1971, Gacy became engaged to Carol Hoff, whom he had previously dated in high school. Carol and her two young daughters from a previous marriage moved in, and they were married on July 1, 1972. Gacy's mother, who had been living with him, moved out shortly before this wedding. In mid-1973, Gacy quit his job as a cook so he could focus on his construction business, which was growing. Gacy's first known murder was January 3, 1972. According to Gacy's own later account, following a family party the previous evening, he picked up a teenager, Timothy Jack McCoy, from Chicago's Greyhound bus terminal. McCoy was going to visit his father in Omaha, Nebraska, catching the bus the next day. Gacy brought him to his home, and he claimed that he woke early the following morning to find McCoy standing in his bedroom doorway holding a kitchen knife, and that he jumped from his bed and McCoy raised both arms in a gesture of surrender, accidentally cutting Gacy's forearm. Gacy took the knife and banged McCoy's head against the bedroom wall and kicked him against his wardrobe. But McCoy fought back and kicked Gacy in the stomach, doubling him over. Gacy then threw the boy to the floor and stabbed him repeatedly in the chest. Gacy claimed he washed the knife in his bathroom, then went to his kitchen and saw that McCoy had set the breakfast table. McCoy had apparently prepared breakfast and walked into Gacy's room to wake him while carrying the knife. Gacy buried McCoy in his crawl space under the house and covered it with a layer of concrete. McCoy was only known as the Greyhound Bus Boy until his body was identified years later. In 1973, Gacy took a teenage employee to Florida, abused him in their hotel room. After returning to Chicago, this victim drove to Gacy's house and beat him up in his front yard. Gacy told his wife that he was attacked for refusing to pay the boy for a poor quality painting job. Gacy's second murder was January 1974, and the victim was placed in Gacy's closet before burial. Gacy told Carol that he was bisexual after they had sex on Mother's Day 1975, and he told her that this would be the last time. Gacy would be gone all night, returning in the early mornings, saying that he had been working late or in business meetings. Carol knew that Gacy brought teenage boys into his garage, and she found gay pornography and men's wallets and identification inside the house. When she asked about all of those, he told her it was none of her business. In October 1975, Gacy and Carol divorced, and she and her daughters remained in the house until February 1976. On March 2nd, the Gacy's divorce was granted on the false grounds that Gacy's infidelity had been with women. By 1975, TDM had expanded and Gacy was working up to 16 hours per day. In March 1977, he became a supervisor for PE Systems, a firm specializing in the remodeling of drugstores. By 1978, Gacy's PDM company had an annual revenue of over $200,000. That's around $2 million today. Gacy joined the Jolly Joker Clown Club and performed at fundraising events, parades, entertaining hospitalized children. He became Pogo the Clown and Patches the Clown. He described Pogo as a happy clown, whereas Patches was a more serious character. Later, Gacy himself would become known as the Killer Clown. Much of his workers were high school students and young men, and he would often take advantage through coercion or threats, insisting on sexual favors in return for lending his vehicles, financial assistance, or even promotions. He claimed to own guns, telling one employee, "Do you know how easy it would be to get one of my guns and kill you, and how easy it would be to get rid of the body?" In May 1975, Gacy hired teenager Anthony Antonucci. In July, he went to the boy's home as he had an injured foot. They drank a bottle of wine, watched a heterosexual stag film. Then Gacy placed Antonucci on the floor and cuffed his hands behind his back. Antonucci managed to get one hand free while Gacy was in another room. Antonucci, who was a high school wrestler, overpowered Gacy and took the key and then cuffed Gacy's hands behind his back. Gacy promised to leave if he was freed. Antonucci agreed and Gacy left. But Antonucci still worked for PDM for 9 more months and Gacy made no further attempts to assault him. In 1975, Gacy was director of Chicago's annual Polish Constitution Day parade, which he would supervise until 1978, and he stomped for President Jimmy Carter, becoming an insider, and was photographed with First Lady Rosalynn Carter wearing an S pin, indicating a person who had been given special security clearance and cleared by the Secret Service. The United States Secret Service would later be chastised for this fact. On July 26, 1976, Gacy offered young hitchhiker David Cram a job. On August 21st, Cram moved into Gacy's house. The next day, Cram and Gacy, dressed as Pogo and Patches, had several drinks to celebrate his 19th birthday. Cram was lured into being handcuffed in front of his body rather than from behind. Gacy intended to assault him, but Cram kicked Gacy in the face and broke free. Gacy then entered Cram's bedroom a month later to assault him, saying, "Dave, you really don't know who I am. Maybe it would be good for you if you just give me what I want." Cram resisted, and Gacy left, stating, "You ain't no fun." Cram moved out of Gacy's house on October 5th and left PDM, but he still did periodic work for 2 more years. Another teenager, Michael Rossi, moved in and had worked for PDM since May 23, 1976. He lived with Gacy until April 1977, sometimes assisting Gacy in clown shows at various events with Gacy as Pogo and Rossi as Patches. Gacy began his killing spree by impersonating police officers and cruising for young boys, offering them work. They were usually lured to his home and tricked into drinking alcohol and being handcuffed as part of a magic trick. His methods during or after the abuse and tortures varied, from strangulation, beatings, stabbing, or even drowning in his bathtub, where he would revive a victim and repeat the process. Gacy usually placed the corpses under his bed for up to 24 hours before burying them in the crawlspace under his house, pouring quicklime to hasten decomposition, while a few were embalmed in his garage prior to burial. Gacy was prolific, and here is the list of identified victims in order with the date that they were murdered or went missing. Details about how they died came from Gacy's own confessions and coroner's reports, which he later recanted. Timothy McCoy, January 3, 1972, was the first victim. He was stabbed. John Butkovich, July 31, 1975, employee who confronted Gacy over unpaid wages. Butkovich's car was later found abandoned with his jacket and wallet inside and the keys in the ignition. Follows were Daryl Sampson on April 6, 1976, Ronald Reffitt, May 14, 1976, Samuel Stapleton, May 14, 1976, a double homicide. Michael Bonin, June 3, 1976. William Carroll, June 13, 1976. James Hackinson, August 5, 1976. Rick Johnston, August 6, 1976. Kenneth Parker, October 24, 1976. Michael Marino, October 24, 1976, his second double homicide. William Bundy, October 26, 1976. Francis Alexander, December 1, 1976. Gregory Godsick, December 12, 1976. John Syke, January 20th, 1977, John Prestige, March 15th, 1977, Matthew Bowman, July 5th, 1977, Robert Gilroy, September 15th, 1977, John Mowry, September 25th, 1977, Russell Nelson, October 17th, 1977, Robert Winch, November 10th, 1977, Tommy Bowling, November 18th, 1977, David Talsma, December 9th, 1977, William Kinder, February 16, 1978, Timothy O'Rourke, June 1978, Frank Landingen, November 4, 1978, James Mazzara, November 24, 1978, and his final victim, Robert Peast, December 11, 1978. Now, this last victim, Robert Peast, his disappearance led to Gacy's arrest on December 21, 1978. Robert Peast was a high school student who disappeared after telling his mother that he was going to meet Gacy about a job. Peast was last seen leaving his job at the pharmacy to meet Gacy, who offered him a job with PDM Contractors. After Peast's family reported him missing, police took the case seriously due to his responsible nature. Police executed a search warrant for Gacy's home, where they found a ring belonging to one of the missing boys and driver's licenses and other personal items of missing young men. They found handcuffs, books on homosexuality and pedophilia, and a receipt from the pharmacy where Peast worked on that day the boy disappeared, which was stamped the day that Peast disappeared, and that disappearance was confirmed by an employee eyewitness. Although no bodies were found, officers noted foul odors emanating from his house, which they suspected were related to decomposing bodies. Gacy was placed under police surveillance and followed, and he once confessed when he was drunk to his attorney, Sam Amarante, that he had tortured, abused, and killed at least 30 young men. An investigating officer later recalled the horrified lawyer's instructions to him, "Don't let Gacy leave." Gacy was arrested when he was seen handing a bag of marijuana to a gas station attendant, prompting another home search warrant on December 21, 1978, that revealed the first human remains in the crawlspace, and Gacy was arrested. Gacy confessed to the murders and led investigators to the remains, but many are still unidentified despite many years of DNA testing. Over the next few weeks, police excavated the crawlspace and backyard, uncovering the remains of 29 victims. 4 additional bodies were discovered in local rivers, bringing the total to 33 confirmed victims. But how did Gacy avoid being a suspect for so long? Gacy's public service and high-profile work in the Democrat Party prevented law enforcement from looking at him for years, despite circumstantial evidence and suspicion, which allowed him more time to kill. Gacy's defense team initially pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, but the prosecution argued that Gacy was fully aware of his actions due to his premeditation and his consciousness of guilt by hiding the bodies, and they sought the death penalty. Several police officers and investigators testified about the searches and discoveries at Gacy's house. The case went to trial on February 6, 1980, and Gacy was found guilty after only 2 hours of jury deliberation on March 13, 1980. He was convicted of murdering 33 young men and boys, and 26 victims were buried in the crawl space of his home, and 3 were buried in his backyard. 4 were found in the Des Plaines River. Psychiatric experts testified that Gacy suffered from multiple personality disorder, claiming that his alter ego, Jack Hanley, had committed the murders. The prosecution argued that Gacy's meticulous planning and efforts to cover up the murders proved he was fully aware of his crimes. Medical experts testified about the cause of death for many of the victims, most of whom were strangled or suffocated. While in prison, Gacy wrote his own autobiography challenging the investigation and his conviction. John Wayne Gacy was sentenced to death and remained on death row for 14 years until he was executed by lethal injection at the Stateville Correctional Center in Crest Hill, Illinois, on May 10, 1994. His final statement before getting the needle was, "Kiss my ass." However, investigations still continue as there is a connection between John Wayne Gacy and a large child sex trafficking ring that existed where many children went missing, and that may hold the key to certain mysteries that remain in the case. Due to the heavy and spurious restrictions by YouTube on perceived graphic, visual, and verbal content, if you want to have more details of this case, please go to the sources in the description box. Thank you for watching this episode of Forgotten History. If you liked what you saw, please click like, share, and subscribe. And if you would like to assist with the ever-increasing cost of production, please consider becoming a channel member and joining our Patreon page. Please check out our merchandise store. And thanks for watching. Still continue as there is a connection between John Wayne Gacy and a large child sex trafficking ring that existed where many children went missing, and that may hold the key to certain mysteries that remain in the case. Due to the heavy and spurious restrictions by YouTube on perceived graphic, visual, and verbal content, if you want to have more details of this case, please go to the sources in the description box. Thank you for watching this episode of Forgotten History. If you liked what you saw, please click like, share, and subscribe. And if you would like to assist with the ever-increasing cost of production, please consider becoming a channel member and joining our Patreon page. Please check out our merchandise store. And thanks for watching.